House Judiciary Committee for Wednesday, May 9th, 2007. We're going to jump to the end of the agenda and do Senate Bill 590 first, and then we'll go back to the top of the agenda and proceed probably in the order in which it was printed. So I'll begin by opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 590. Council Stanton.
Thank you, Chair McPherson, and members of the committee. Senate Bill 590 relates to the crime of criminal impersonation. ORS 162.365 creates a Class A misdemeanor for persons who injure, deceive, or defraud another, or who intend to obtain a benefit by falsely impersonating a, quote, public servant, close quote. ORS 162.005 sub 2 defines this term public servant as an officer or employee of the state or any political subdivision of the state, an advisor, consultant, or assistant acting at the request of the state or any political subdivision of the state, a person nominated, elected, or appointed to a position but not yet filling the role, and then jurors. If the public servant is a peace officer, judge, or justice of the peace, the offense is a Class C felony as opposed to a Class A misdemeanor. Senate Bill 590 amends this statute, ORS 162.365, in the following ways. First of all, it adds to facilitate an unlawful activity to the intent options. Instead of right now it's merely intent to injure, defraud, etc., with this bill it would add to facilitate an unlawful activity. That's the first change. The second change is it includes the impersonation of an active member or veteran of the armed forces of the United States.
Okay, thank you, Council. And we have Senator Beyer, one of the sponsors of the bill here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Roger Beyer, State Senator, District 9, here to talk to you about Senate Bill 590. And I don't know how many other people are signed up, but I know at least General Caldwell from the military department is here, hopefully to speak on this bill. He testified in favor of it. So if you'd like the other proponents to come forward, that would be fine with me. I will be very brief, Mr. Chair and members. This bill is patterned after a bill that passed in Washington in, I believe it was 03. It may have been 04, as they have annual sessions in Washington, but I'm pretty sure it was the 03 session. And simply that there are people out there who are doing, impersonating active members of the military or veterans in order to fraudulently obtain benefits that they do not deserve. And this bill would simply add that classification to the type of people who it is already unlawful to impersonate. And it's a fairly simple bill, and I would hope that you would look favor upon it and move it forward. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Senator Beyer. Any questions? Okay, if not, let's hear from General Caldwell.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Brigadier General Mike Caldwell, Deputy Director at the Military Department. We, too, support the bill. We think the bill sends a good signal to our society that there are some things that we just shouldn't tolerate. And I think anytime somebody does this, clearly they're looking for an advantage. They're trying to defraud somebody. They're trying to get something they don't deserve. And I think that's a good message and good public policy for the state of Oregon. So we fully support the bill. Happy to answer any questions.
Any questions for the general?
Yes. Senator and to the general, thank you very much. As a veteran, I appreciate this very much. And we've heard a lot of horror stories about how it has been abused and defrauded people, and it's the right thing to do. Thank you.
I would say, Mr. Chairman, Representative Wisnett, we've had just a couple of incidences where we've been informed of things, and usually through police agencies. So it isn't as profound as it was. And I'll tell you that during the Gulf War, it was ridiculous. It was just absurd. I couldn't believe it. It was amazing what happened during that period of time and some of the things that occurred and some of the people that were out in uniform being invited to different groups speaking, and they were phony as a $3 bill. So we haven't heard as much of that this time around, which is good. So maybe some of this is working.
Okay. Thank you, General. We've got two other people signed up. Jim Willis. We also have H.A. McDonald. I don't know if it's reasonable, appropriate for both of you to come forward at once.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jim Willis. I'm director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. I want to strongly support Senate Bill 590. And I want to make a comment about the fact that this bill dovetails very nicely with the act that was passed last session of the United States Congress, which was called the Stolen Valor Act, wherein it made it unlawful for persons to wear medals awarded for various acts of valor in the United States Armed Forces that they did not deserve, and made them subject to a criminal arrest and prosecution. This, at the state level, as the general just testified, allows us to actively pursue and prosecute those individuals who are either wearing a military uniform or impersonating a veteran of the armed forces. And my concern as a former and retired police officer is those people who have actively represented themselves as raising money for veterans organizations and saying that they were in fact themselves a veteran. This would be a very good tool for the Oregon law enforcement community to pursue and prosecute such persons. I congratulate the body for considering this bill and strongly support it. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Let's hear from Mr. McDonald, and we can take questions.
My name is Matt McDonald. I represent the United Veterans of Oregon, which is every veterans organization in the state except one. And we strongly support the bill. We think it's long overdue, and we hope it moves forward.
Thank you, Mr. McDonald. Any questions for either of these? Okay. Thank you, gentlemen. I have a question for counsel on the what do we say to him to assume the character of it? The the change in the language is to delete falsely impersonates, and to go with the phrasing the assumed character of. Isn't that the sort of the operative language here? So what we're trying to get the bottom of is in what sense is it stating that one is a member of the armed forces, or is it wearing the uniform of the armed forces? What is the sort of the conduct that the bill would define or capture?
Mr. Chair, you're correct. It changes the language. Falsely impersonates a public servant. That is eliminated, and I think in part that is to because there's a different category of person. That's the structural change, because it's now not only public servant or armed member or veteran of the armed forces. So it breaks that apart. But the falsely impersonates language is gone, and so the operative verb, if you will, is does an act in the assumed character of. And there's not much case law on this particular provision, what that would entail, but my reading of the plain language is assumed character would imply you're in a uniform, but not necessarily. You could just be saying that you are a member of the armed forces, and any action in that assumed character would subject you to this statute. I don't know that falsely impersonates versus does an act in the assumed character of, in terms of any substantive differences. I think that my reading of it is it's essentially the same thing, six and a half dozen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a similar question to counsel, and now it raises the. I like this bill. I think it's going to do a good thing. I just want to make sure it's doing what it's supposed to. I had a concern about taking out the falsely impersonates, because both were in there before, the falsely impersonates and the assumed character. But I also wonder about the purpose for including to facilitate an unlawful activity, because they're already committing the crime of criminal impersonation. So I just wonder where the to facilitate an unlawful activity language came from, why that was added.
Mr. Chair, I think that Director Davis talked about the fact that, you know, people were soliciting money, and that would that not be a separate falsely?
You would have deceiver to fraud in that standpoint.
Right. Or obtain a benefit.
Yeah. from existing language. I'm trying to think of a situation where facilitate an unlawful activity. And it certainly gives an additional option that injure, deceive, or defraud another doesn't. It's an easier standard of proof. Right now, I'm not thinking of a specific example of.
Somebody could be saying, "I'm selling an ad for a veteran's paper," and they're not exactly impersonating a veteran, but I mean, they could be doing that or trying something like that. I would think would be what that was trying to cover with somebody. I guess that would also come under the defraud or deceive, but maybe just makes it a little more clear. So you don't have people. I mean, I know a lot of police type publications. You'll have somebody saying, "Oh yeah, it's tough riding a motorcycle last night," and they're just working a boiler room. They're not a cop. And
one situation that I can perhaps think of is if you have. This isn't the best explanation, but where you have people working in conjunction with one another. And you have the ringleader in the uniform doing everything, saying things, and then the person sitting next to him who doesn't necessarily... It would be a harder standard of proof that the person who's quiet and just going along with everything to injure, deceive, or defraud another. It's harder for me as a prosecutor to prove that for the silent partner than it would be just to say that he's facilitating an unlawful activity. If I have a choice between the two, I'm definitely going with facilitating an unlawful activity in that sense, standpoint. And I think this picks up those situations, perhaps, as one example.
Mr. Chair, and the personates a public servant there, I think the courts might have trouble saying that somebody who was a veteran was a public servant, fitting that into that piece. I mean, you may be doing, like somebody like me who was, you know, just did one hitch in the Marines and then went on to a different career. If I'd gone into working at Freightliner, for example, you wouldn't call me a public servant. So I think that's why that was eliminated.
I guess the thing that I was focusing in on, and actually the facility and unlawful activity, I'm not so concerned about because it's just one of a series. But the earlier verb is to in order to deceive another. Assumes the character of. So it would seem that this would be triggered by somebody just appearing in uniform when they're not a member of the armed forces, just to deceive, just to make somebody else believe that they were a member of the armed forces.
But Mr. Chair, it's not just putting a uniform. Like I said, if you use your name and you put it in a publication, I think that's why the facilitated an unlawful activity is, you know, I tell you that I'm a hero from World War II, and you go out and collect money. You're using my name and something I did not do to solicit money or to do stage an event or something like that. So it's not it's the name and saying you have an honor you don't have or something. I think more than just the uniform.
The Wes Cooley, if you remember him.
Parker,
I do remember that sad chapter in Oregon
Representative
politics.
I have abundance as I served in Korea with Wes Cooley.
But we're not going to go there. No, there's another politician I could go somewhere.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Beyer.
I think it's important, again, this is Roger Beyer. I think it's important to point out that before that, in line 5 of the bill, the person has to, with the intent to obtain a benefit. So just someone putting on a uniform would not be doing it. They have to have the intent has to be that they obtain a benefit. I think that is it's operative language there. And I'd like to put on the record that a child put wearing a uniform for Halloween would not be considered an attempt to obtain a benefit.
What about the candy?
You're going to have to give value someplace. But that did come up in the Senate hearing, Mr. Chairman. I just like to put on the record that it would not be the intent that Halloween costumes and children going out trick-or-treating would not be considered a crime or a misdemeanor in this for the intent of this bill.
And kids wear a uniform, the camouflage and stuff, just their kids. So, I mean, they're not trying to.
It's awkward language to me. Okay.
If I may, just for one clarification, the way that the bill is written grammatically, it would appear that there are three intent options. And I'm basing this on the placement of the comma. Option one, as a prosecutor, is I show that the person has the intent to obtain a benefit. And then there's a comma. And then it's option two, to injure, deceive, or defraud another. Option three, to facilitate an unlawful activity.
Should be a semicolon.
Yeah,
that's my grammatical reading.
And I think
counsel, does the with intent go before each clause? With intent to injure, deceive, or defraud, or with intent to facilitate an unlawful activity? I think you have to have the intent.
Well, I think you do have to have intent, but the point Senator Beyer was making is he thinks that you always have to have an intent to obtain a benefit. And I don't read it that way. I'd say I think it's if with intent to deceive, the person assumes the character of an active member or veteran of the armed forces of the United States. I mean, I think literally it means that if I put on a uniform and it's implying to people who see me that I am a member of the armed forces when I'm not, that I have committed this crime. Just by trying to communicate to people that I'm a member of the armed forces.
Mr. Chair, I would agree with that reading as it is right now. That's I'm looking up the definition of deceive just to see what, because I don't think it's defined by the statutes, and just so you would resort to the plain language or the dictionary definition. To be false, to fail to fulfill, to cheat, to cause to accept as true or valid what is false or invalid, to practice deceit, to lead astray. Those are the dictionary definitions.
What I'd like to do, Senator Beyer, is maybe work with the language a bit here and make sure we're accomplishing the intent, because I think that the intent is to try to get at people who are misusing the uniform or associating themselves with military service in order to get people to do things like to donate or to, you know, I mean, that's what I understand the purpose is here.
Mr. Chair, yes, as I said, I think that the intent to obtain a benefit is supposed to be, as I read it and as I intended the bill to be, is that the person has to be trying to obtain a benefit before they would be committing the violation.
Yeah, no, and Mr. Chair, in criminal impersonation, we have people who put on police uniform, pretend to be a police, and they're not really seeking a benefit. They're just seeking to, maybe they're stopping cars or something just for their own ego, and that falls under that. They get convicted under this statute for doing that. So I think you don't have to, I mean, I think benefit's one thing, and that may have been what we primarily looked at on with the armed forces, but it just the fact that they're pretending to be something they're not in that manner is we're going to make it criminal in this statute, and I don't have a problem with doing that.
Representative Krieger.
Well, that's like receiving recognition as having served when you haven't, because these people are held up. We all respect our veterans, and we stand up oftentimes when they come to the side aisle and they're going to leave and go up and be deployed. They're looked up to, and they're trying to receive the benefit of what they're not.
Yeah.
One other clarification, if I may, Mr. Chair, is that under existing law, so forget about the bill, 162.365 reads, a person commits the crime of criminal impersonation if, with intent to obtain a benefit, or to injure, deceive, or defraud another. And so I think under existing law right now, if a person puts on the uniform of some sort of public servant, whether it's a police officer, whether it's a peace officer, whether it's a judge, whether it's whatever, they are just to deceive. They're guilty of this offense right now, whether or not they're trying to obtain a benefit. And that's existing law.
Right. That seems a bit broad to me. It seems like it's the injury is trying to extract something from someone rather than just to get the sort of the respect and honor that goes with wearing the uniform.
Well, Mr. Chair, if I may, whether it's a uniform or not, I'm a little bit confused as to why we would not respect that uniform, and the fact if somebody put that on to gain honor, whether they injured you, if it was your uniform or not, but to just gain honor and bring a benefit to themselves through that, through wearing that uniform with the intent of gaining something, I think that's a problem. I think I heard Senator Beyer mention, what about a legislator, you know, somebody who's going out and representing themselves as one of us.
I'm going to bring him on her.
With an attempt to, you know, for whatever reason they're doing, I think this bill gets at people who are trying to be somebody who they really aren't and represent themselves to the public in that way.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that there, it's pretty clear that there's criminal intent required. So that part doesn't concern me. I just want to make sure and get some verification from counsel that taking out the false impersonation language still does, that the bill still does what we want it to do. Because the false impersonation, and I understand the concern about limiting it to public service. We don't want to do that because we're adding the armed forces in there. But by taking out false impersonation, are we left with enough to give the bill the teeth that it needs?
Mr. Chair, I still think that was dumb because we've added it down as number A. Maybe they shouldn't have put it in A and just gone directly.
Well, it's not the public servant language.
It's the falsely impersonate. Is Representative Bonamici's point.
And Representative Bonamici, I falsely impersonates. Originally, it was falsely impersonates and doesn't act in the assumed character. That's the original bill. And now we have doesn't act in the assumed character. And what does the one capture that the other does not, if anything? I don't see that. First of all, I think to some extent falsely impersonates is a little redundant. I mean, if you're impersonating somebody, isn't the false implied? But I don't see doing an act in the assumed character seems to me to capture falsely impersonates, what everything falsely impersonates does. So I think, to me, it's the same.
With committee, what I would suggest, since we've got a long agenda here and we're taking quite a bit of time on this one, is that we close the public hearing on this because we've got, I think, all the input we need. And let's just kind of have some offline discussion with council and make sure we've got the language the way we think it ought to read.
Just for the record, I'm okay with the bill like it is.
Okay.
I am too.
And just for the record, I am too.
Okay, I'm hearing it.
Ready.
Yeah.
I'm okay.
Work session coming up.
To the extent that the concern is over the ability to prosecute somebody who puts on a uniform or for some reason I'm thinking of the movie Wedding Crashers, pretending to be a member of the military and going to try to use it to meet women or whatever, and that they're going to prosecute people for that. Good idea. There are a number of...
Obtained is...
Never mind.
There has to be criminal.
There has to be a criminal intent, and to some extent there are a number of bills that exist that it's not always safe to say you got to rely on prosecutorial discretion to some extent, but there are a lot of bills out there that could be prosecuted very broadly where a prosecutor's role is to look and say that's not the intent of this, and... I don't know if that's helpful at all. That would be one of them, to not prosecute those sorts of cases. Again, the criminal intent element.
Well, what I would say, committee, is that this is the last portal before the floor and before, because it's passed one chamber, so that this is the last time we consider these things, and I just want to make sure that we get the language the way we want it to be. So what I would recommend is that we let this one sit for a little while so we look at the language and reflect on it, because which we do whatever we do with it, if we move it out as is, given the subject matter, it's moving right through.
Mr. Chair, can we get that done and get that bill back in here and out of here? I mean, there's not that much to do.
Understand.
I'm willing to go along with it if I get your assurance that we're going to do this.
Okay. You have my assurance. Okay, thank you, Representative Krieger. I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 590 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 233.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 233 allows the State Accident Insurance Fund, commonly known as SAFE, to contract with the Oregon Department of Administrative Services to provide claim management services for claims filed by prisoners for injuries suffered during authorized work or occupational training.
And we have David Hartwig from DAS.
Chair McPherson, members of the committee, my name is David Hartwig. I'm administrator of the State Services Division within the Department of Administrative Services. Just a little bit of background to this bill. SAFE has been administering inmate injury claims since 1991, first on behalf of Department of Justice and then subsequently on behalf of Department of Administrative Services. DAS involvement began following a vote in 1994. Voters approved a constitutional amendment which required injuries be made out of a correctional systems fund rather than workers' compensation. Subsequent legislation in 1995 directed DAS to develop rules to create this program in cooperation with Department of Corrections. An inmate injury fund was established as a component of the state insurance fund, which is administered by the Department of Administrative Services Risk Management Program. Risk Management continued the contractual agreement with SAFE to administer these claims. During a contract renewal process in 2005, it was determined that SAFE did not explicitly have authority to administer these claims, and so this is what Senate Bill 233 tries to address, is to make clear that SAFE has the authority to administer the inmate injury claims. We've worked with SAFE for a long time on this. We think they are the most efficient and effective way to administer these claims. We leverage their staff expertise, their processes, their data management systems. Inmate injury is unique to state government. Hiring a third-party administrator wouldn't appear to be as effective. We'd have to retain a third-party administrator and train them in this aspect that's similar to workers' compensation but not exactly the same way. Risk management would not want to take this administration, these claims, into our administration for a couple of reasons. One, we don't have staff that currently have background in workers' compensation claims. We don't do that. The second aspect would be that it would potentially put us in a conflict of interest in regards to handling an inmate injury claim that perhaps we would deny, and then subsequently we'd have a tort claim challenging that denial. Just a little bit of information about the number of claims that are processed through this program. From July 1st, 2001 through December 31st, 2006, 578 claims were denied. So that's an average denial of 105 claims a year. 49 claims during this period were determined to have some monetary value. The average number of claims that had a monetary value in that period was 9, and the average cost of an accepted claim was $1,965. When there's the determination that there's a monetary value to the claim, the funds are held in an account. Inmates can only access that following their release. Following their release, they have to make an application process to obtain those funds. So with that, I'll conclude and answer questions if there are any.
Any questions for Mr. Hartwig? Representative Krieger.
Correct, Mr. Chair. I'm not quite understanding. Is the state kind of self-insuring themselves at corrections, and you're administering it? I'm not connecting how the process is.
Chair McPherson, Representative Krieger, that's exactly how we do. We self-fund. Risk management develops a charge back to Department of Correction based on the claims history and the cost for those claims, so we do self-fund that.
Any further questions? I guess, Mr. Hartwig, I'm still trying to absorb what's the significance of having DAS take on the claim management process rather than having it be handled the people who would ordinarily handle workers' comp issues?
Mr. Chair, DAS technically does not administer the claims. That's done by SAFE. We contract with them to do that. We're primarily.
Well, I beg your pardon. So what's happening is DAS, I'm sorry to break in, but I mean, it's involving SAFE in the handling of these claims because they're workers' comp claims. That's the point, isn't it?
Yes, Mr. Gotcha. Chair. That's how it started and continued since 1991.
I'm starting to understand what's going on here then. Any further questions to the committee? If not, then I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 233 and open a work session on Senate Bill 233.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 233 to the floor with a due pass.
Representative Barker moves Senate Bill 233 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
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 Aye. Aye. Aye. Senate Bill 233 goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and this would seems like good for the consent calendar. Yeah. Is there any objection to a consent calendar posting? Representative Flores, I'm looking at you since you're the champion of floor presentations.
Well, Mr. Chair.
It wasn't on the consent calendar in the Senate.
Okay, well, maybe that should be carried on our floor then.
No consent calendar.
I'm sorry?
I don't think there is a consent calendar in the Senate.
No. That might be. That's a good reason.
I'd be happy to carry it if you want to carry
some misunderstanding by the chair as to that this was connecting SAFE to DAS.
I was reading it in the reverse, but Representative Cameron has volunteered to carry it, so I appreciate his.
Thank you.
So it would be Senate Bill 233 moving forward with a due pass with Representative Cameron carrying. I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 233 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 267A.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. In 1999, the legislature permitted municipal courts and justice courts to become courts of record. Appeals from courts of record are to the Court of Appeals rather than the circuit courts, but in practice, the appellate courts have found it difficult to keep track of which courts have and have not become courts of record. Senate Bill 267A would create requirements for justice or municipal courts to become or cease to operate as courts of record.
I'd like to invite Kingsley Click from the Judicial Department forward.
Good morning. For the record, I'm Kingsley Click, State Court Administrator. And as counsel explained, this is a housekeeping bill to fix a process, or actually to designate an easy process to address when municipal and justice courts are courts of record. Because after a case, an appeal, if it's not a court of record, goes to our circuit courts. If it is a court of record, then it goes to our courts of appeal. And when the appellate courts get it right now, they have no idea if it's properly filed and they have proper jurisdiction or not. They have to make contact with the court and do all that. So their suggestion was we set up a simple process by which a municipal court or justice court, when it becomes a court of record, sends up a declaration to the Supreme Court. It's entered in our formal registry, and then it's on the books as a court of record. And similarly, when it ceases to be a court of record, they would send up a declaration. It would be entered, and then they could cease. And then there's a grandfather clause for those few courts that are courts of record now that would, after the bill goes into effect, would give them at least 6 months to send up their declaration. So that's basically what the bill does. It just sets up a formal process to readily determine if a court is a court of record or not when the appeal comes into one of our courts.
Representative Barker.
If a municipal court decides they don't want to be a court of record, are they going to still hear drunk driving cases? We're having a problem with keeping record of convictions. Yeah.
Chair McPherson, Representative Barker, as I understand it, under the current statutes, they have that jurisdiction. What would happen is if they had an appeal from a conviction in that case, it would go to our circuit court. If they were not a court of record, if they were a court of record, it would go to our appellate courts. And what it means if it went to our circuit court is it would be de novo. It would be tried anew as a new case.
Ms. Cook, what proportion of our justice and municipal courts are courts of record now?
Chairman McPherson, very few. I think we know of two for sure. There have been, there has been legislation this session that may encourage more courts to become courts of record, and this would help us in that regard if that happens.
Ms. Chair, what was the bill we passed or that
we had a hearing on a bill that would have required municipal courts in cities under 10,000 to be a court of record, but that bill did not move forward. So we still have a situation where they basically can choose themselves whether to be courts of record or not. And as I understand this bill, it doesn't change that situation. They can still choose to be or not to be courts of record. It just says that here's what you'd have to do to formally establish the court as such.
Chair McPherson, that's correct as far as for the appellate court system.
Okay. Mr. Chair, just to be clear, this is just establishing a record, notice of a record, and on the way in and on the way out, I guess. It doesn't give them any details of what they have to do as far as court reporting and what the other bill was talking about. That's correct.
Thank you, Chairman McPherson. Representative Cameron, that's correct. It's just a notice provision. Really.
Any further questions for Ms. Click? Then I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 267 and open a work session on Senate Bill 267.
Mr. Chair, I move the House Bill 267A to Senate Bill 267A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Cameron moves Senate Bill 267A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion of the motion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Bonamici.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Representative
Hoff.
Aye.
Representative Krieger.
Aye.
Representative
Breed.
Aye.
Aye.
Vice President Barker.
Aye.
Aye. Senate Bill 267A moves to the floor of the due pass recommendation. Representative Bonamici, thank you very much. I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 267 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 271A.
Thank you, Chairman McPherson, members of the committee. Senate Bill 271A is the product of the Oregon Judicial Department's Fee Waiver Deferral Policy Work Group, which was formed to study current court fee waiver and deferral processes. The bill would replace ORS 21.605, which concerns the waiver or deferral of filing fees, court costs, and transcripts on appeal. It would establish that a court in a civil action may waive or defer fees for a party if it determines that the party is unable to pay. It allows a presiding judge to delegate this authority to a court administrator, but permits a party to appeal this decision to a court. The bill also authorizes the Supreme Court to create standards and practices for the waiver or deferral of fees or costs. It permits a court to enter a judgment in favor of the government against the party for any deferred costs and fees. It also establishes that if a person had a fee waived and then prevails in the case, and the losing party would be liable to the winning party for costs and disbursements, then the court may require the losing party to pay the state the waived amount. Finally, the bill establishes that all information collected in applying for a waiver or deferral of fees would be confidential.
Ms. Click.
I'm Kingsley Click, State Court Administrator. And as counsel explained, this was a product of a work group with the department and with external people involved in the issue of fee and waiver deferral. How this came about is on the statutes, and for over 20 years has been the authority for the courts to allow fees or to be waived or deferred in any kind of case action. There was wide disparity across our courts in this area. Even within a court, it could be judge by judge. There was an interest, one, because we're a unified state court system, to have consistent practices in this area. And also there was some litigation that was cropping up around the divergent practices. So at the request of the presiding judges and Chief Justice at the time, Wallace Carson, a work group was set up to come up with recommendations on how to provide a more uniform parameter for courts to operate in this area. One of the products of that is this bill, and then there's also a number of implementing recommendations that the work group made. Council went over actually the basic framework of this bill. Most of it, I just wanted to point out, was legislative council wanting to redraft current statutes. So we did include what the current statutes provide at the end of my testimony, and then we tried, as we explained the various sections, to identify what was a rewrite of current law and what was actually new. The parts, as council pointed out, that are more new to work around with the authority of the courts in this area is, one, giving a tool for there to be a first-line review of the requests by court staff if they're under these written guidelines established by the Chief Justice and then by the judges of that court. There also is clarification that any fee or waiver that is granted and the payment provisions, that this goes on our separate collections track, and there is no authority to hold up a judgment based on that final fee waiver or deferral. This is based on current law, but it's not in statute. We also provide for forms to be developed. Those are ones that are very different. Some courts have a very elaborate process right now of many pages of information to fill out. Other courts just say check off the box. So this work group has developed some simple forms. The beauty is one of the things that they've built into the process is if another state or federal agency has already made a determination of your ability to pay, they can use that documentation as their starting point rather than going back through the same information as long as it's current. The other thing, we update the judgments provision. This was not updated with the last few sessions of work on the judgment bill, so now it's clear that any fee waiver is part of the limited general and supplemental judgment provisions, that in order to enter an order, you do it under one of those authorities. And the confidentiality is consistent with what happens now with financial information. If there's, you know, fraud or other things involved, then that information can be used, but it's not generally public information. I have members of the work group with me in the audience. Jim Nass, Appellate Legal Counsel, Karen Hightower, Deputy Legal Counsel, and Jim Murchison, who's Marion County Trial Court Administrator. There were other members of the work group, but they are here to answer any real detailed questions about the bill or the work. Thank you.
They're not signed up here, but do you think it would be helpful for them to, or do you, are they simply a resource for us in case we need them?
Chairman McPherson, a resource for the committee.
Okay, very good. Any questions? Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Clegg, for being here. I have a question about the prevailing party, the new provision. And the way I read your excellent summary here, this allows the court to order the losing party to pay the prevailing party's fees if the prevailing party's fees were waived. And that's a new provision. Is that something that is typical in other states, or are some jurisdictions doing that, or are courts forbidden from doing that now? I'm just interested in how that this proposed change came about.
Chair McPherson, Representative Bonamici, I asked Karen Hightower to come up on that issue. My understanding is that the courts currently have that authority, it's just not expressed.
Board Director Karen Hightower, Deputy Legal Counsel at the State Court Administrator's Office. Mr. Chair, Representative Bonamici, it's not really new law. We've sort of revised it. If you look at the back of your packet at attachment number 2, we put the old statute there. If you look at subsection 4, there is a provision currently. What we've done is updated that provision and made it clearer. It's slightly different in that we've put the state on the same, subject to the same standards as any other litigant. But basically, this is a discretionary provision, so that if somebody comes in and they have had their plaintiff has been unable to pay fees, and the court at the beginning says, I know you can never pay the fees because you just don't have the money. So at the beginning of the case, the judge has completely waived the fees. If that party in the end ends up prevailing, then the judge at the end of the case has the discretion to say, okay, you know, losing party, it's partially your fault that the plaintiff had to bring this case. And so the judge could, in his or her discretion, allow the waived fees be paid by the prevailing party. And basically, this is a collection sort of issue. So when fees are waived, it just means the state has not been paid the filing fee. So it's another mechanism to increase our collections that is purely discretionary.
Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Either Ms. Click or Ms. Hightower, I'm just interested, as a matter of curiosity, on your testimony, Section 3, page 4, regarding the forms. New provision requires courts to provide the forms to request fee waivers or deferrals. I seem to have recollection there's already a standardized form for waiver of fees and costs, so I'm just curious about this.
Mr. Chair, Representative Flores, for your record, Karen Hightower again. Currently, most courts do provide forms for free. Every court creates the forms in their own way. So part of this work group, we have created standardized forms. That has been one of the concerns with legal services, that in every county they have a slightly different procedure and slightly different forms. So they thought it would be less confusing to have a more standardized procedure. Currently, we don't have standard forms, but every court does have forms. So this work group is trying to standardize that and make it easier when you go from Multnomah County to Clackamas County. It's going to be quite similar, but currently we do provide forms. They're just not standardized. Every court has slightly different forms. And this, after the work group and the Chief Justice order, we should have much more standardized systems, and that's one of the big advantages of this bill, is we are trying to standardize procedures from court to court.
Quick follow-up.
Go ahead.
And so I guess perhaps my recollection is in error, that Stevens Ness has a standard fee waiver form. They don't?
Mr. Chair, Representative Flores, that's a private company. So
law firm publishing.
Right, so they do what they want. We don't control what they do. They would have to follow the local court rules and statutes, but we don't have control over what Stevens Nest does. But every court, if you ask for a fee waiver deferral form, they will provide you a form.
I see. Thank you.
Any further questions? Well, if not, then I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 271A and open a work session on Senate Bill 271A.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 271A to the floor to be passed.
Bill 271A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Hearing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
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 Senate Bill 271A moves to the floor of the due pass recommendation. Anybody, Representative Reed, would you like to carry this bill?
Sure.
Thank you very much. Close the work session on Senate Bill 271A and move and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 81.
Chair McPherson, members of the committee, Senate Bill 81 relates to the information that a court must provide to a defendant before the defendant enters a plea of guilty or no contest. ORS 135.385 establishes various information that a court must provide to a defendant who wishes to plead guilty or to plead no contest to criminal charges. This process is meant to ensure that the defendant makes a knowing and voluntary plea. Among other things, the court must advise each and every defendant of the following. First of all, by pleading, the defendant waives his right to confront witnesses and against self-incrimination and to a trial by jury. Also, that the maximum possible sentence that the defendant faces, and that the defendant could be deported if the defendant is not a United States citizen. Those are examples of some of the things that judges must go over before every plea. Senate Bill 81 expands the information that a court must provide to include the following in sum. If the defendant is pleading to a domestic violence offense, federal law may prohibit the defendant from possessing or transferring any firearm or ammunition, and that a domestic violence conviction may hurt the defendant's ability to serve in the armed forces of the United States or to be employed in law enforcement. The need for the new language arose in 2005 when the United States Congress passed the Violence Against Women Act. For a state to receive funds under this act, it must certify that its policies and practices include notifying domestic violence offenders about the federal laws, which are technically found at 18 United States Code sections 922, subsection G, 8, and 9, those sections that prohibit firearm possession by persons convicted of certain domestic violence offenses.
Okay. General Caldwell. And let me apologize. I didn't realize that you were signed up for yet another bill, or I would have taken this one a little earlier in our time. I thought maybe you were just enjoying the atmosphere of our hearing.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Brigadier General Mike Caldwell, Deputy Director of the Military Department. Probably the dead giveaway was when I opened my Oregonian that I wasn't here for just a actually, I appreciate your consideration. Found the other bills rather interesting. Not spending a lot of time before the Judiciary Committee, any opportunities worthwhile. We ask that this bill be introduced and brought before you. We have found that on not a lot of cases, but in some cases where we've had had members that are currently serving in the Oregon National Guard that were ignorant to the fact of the what we term the Lautenberg laws, impacted their status because of ignorance and pleading when they thought they were going to take some rather light rap on the knuckles for some offense, and come to find out they were ineligible to carry on their duties in the Guard, and we ended up having to discharge them. That's something we take rather seriously, and with respect to making sure we comply with them. And for instance, when we mobilize people, we have a semi-annually we have a process where we call soldier readiness processing where we run everybody through our different stations. One of those is the JAG section, where they go through and they actually run a LEDS, or they ask the soldier if they've ever had any of the of these offenses, and we find them that way. We also, the one that brought this one to case, brought this to our forefront, however, was a full-time National Guardsman who had ended up with a special needs adoption child. Things went haywire between the difficulty of raising this child. They got some really, really bad advice from, I don't know if there's their friends or somebody in the child welfare business. He basically, a full-time soldier, had 16, 17 years of service. And without getting into all the muddy details, he took what he thought was an easy way out, and it ended up being charged as a domestic violence issue. And the teenage child was difficult to manage from the outset, and after about a year and a half of this, the things had gone to pot. Police were involved, DHS was involved, and end result was that he took a plea for a Class C felony. We picked it up in this processing that we do, and it became a situation where we had to discharge him 3 years short of his retirement. It was a real tragedy. We ended up actually delaying the discharge, working with some attorneys to get him good legal counsel, and he finally got it taken care of. But it took a tremendous amount of effort, a tremendous amount of money on his part and time on our part to try to salvage what otherwise was a perfect career for this man, and who had basically set out to do a good thing with a wayward teenage girl that totally disrupted the entire family unit and became impossible for him to manage. And again, it was just a real tragedy, the whole thing was. So this really put it on our screen. We said, well, what can we do to maybe help people not make this mistake before? We had also heard of young men and a few ladies who had tried to join the Guard and suddenly found out that they had copped to a plea earlier in some seemingly innocent or rather low-brow incident, and then they were deferred from doing it. So that's the genesis of why this is before you today. We think we don't want to burden judges any more than they already are with the times, you know, with the court system the way it is and how backed up it is, but we really think this is important, that defendants know that they could have an impact that otherwise they would not have known. So that's pretty much the genesis of it, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, and I'd be more than happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Representative Krieger.
Thank you. I understand the reason for this, but I've always thought that young men's brains don't get in gear till they're 30. And I always looked at the military as a place where someone did kind of maybe go astray, had some discretion when they were young. You could get your life back in order, and it appears that this young man had done that.
Yes, sir.
And I realize you're trying to comply maybe with federal law, but at the same time, it would seem that this was some harm could be done where, you know, the Guard or the military really could be that focal turning point for a person the rest of their life and not having that opportunity. Can you comment on that at all? Or?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Krieger, I suspect you could probably call some of my former high school teachers and they would suggest that maybe I'm one of those examples, but those that are still alive, which aren't that many, but I think that that's true, and I think that in some instances, you know, young people make mistakes that are not so horrific that ruins them for life, but however, something like this, in this particular example that I used, clearly put this man not only in jeopardy of being able to take care of his family, but this particular gentleman was, or soldier, was a, you know, very straight, squared away soldier and citizen, and they set out to actually do what they thought was public good in a small rural town in Oregon, where he was rather much of a leader in that community because it was small, and he was a sergeant first class, which is fairly high in the ranking business. I mean, it's an E7 out of possible E9, so I mean, he was no piker. He was not ignorant to what he does for as a soldier in his life, but he did not understand the intricacies of the court system and or the child welfare system, and he did what he thought was the easiest thing to do, which was to get this teenage girl removed from his household. Upon doing that, the state became the people that really wanted a thumping, and he took this ridiculous plea and ended up just absolutely causing himself an incredible amount of discomfort and cost and everything else, and it was very, very emotional for him and for us because we know this guy's record. So I would agree that there is clearly, and I see this every day. I was in Bend yesterday at our youth challenge program that some of you have been to and are aware of, and in fact, his representative Comp is one of our mentors. So these young men come in here and young ladies all the time, and you're right. I think it takes about 30 years old before you start figuring it out. And it's amazing to see the transformation when given the right guidance. So this is just to help give them the right guidance.
Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't have any problem with the bill. In fact, I think it's a good thing to get that information there to the person who's considering entering a plea. And I know it's one more thing that the judges have to add, but it's already a pretty long list. What I think is important is the fact that if there's this federal law that says that a domestic violence offender is prohibited from possessing a firearm and therefore serving in the military, that information needs to get more widespread so that maybe that'll give me one more reason for somebody to think twice before not just entering a plea, but committing domestic violence. So
domestic violence is bad.
It is, but if this information could be, this is very narrow. It just requires a judge to say it when somebody's entering a plea. If that information could be more widespread, it would just be one more reason for somebody to think twice before engaging in domestic violence.
Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Colonel Caldwell. And when you referred to the Lautenberg
General.
I meant to say General Caldwell. Pardon me, sir.
Long time, so that's okay.
When you referred to the Lautenberg laws, that was the federal laws that
yes,
you were referring to, 18 U.S.C., which were passed in 2005. And those, I just think to reiterate and to make clear, violation or pleading to any of these things may jeopardize your ability to deal with weapons, may jeopardize your ability to enter military, and may jeopardize your law enforcement career. So I guess it would be determined upon either a conviction or the discretion of the court. But I think this is important information that the court should be providing.
Any further questions?
Just one quick one.
Okay.
The bottom of the staff summary says certain domestic violence offenses. Do you know what those are? Are there some things they might do that are not going to be covered in this last words of the staff summary?
Representative Krieger, I can look into that and give you a more accurate summary.
I'd like to know on the side. It's a good bill, though.
Yep. Okay.
Any further questions? Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, General Caldwell. Thank you for your patience in waiting for the second bill to come up. Representative Krieger, I was going to ask whether you would, that's information you'd like to have pinned down before we take this to work session.
No, it's fine as it is. I'd just like to know if there is some that are included and some that might not be.
Okay. Then I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 81 and open a work session on Senate Bill 81.
Mr. Chair, move Senate Bill 81 to the floor to do pass.
Representative Barker moves Senate Bill 81 to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, the clerk call the roll.
Aye.
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 Chairperson.
All right. Senate Bill 81 moves to the floor with a do pass recommendation. And Representative Krieger, if you could carry that, that'd be great. I will close the work session on Senate Bill 81 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 266.
Chair McPherson, members of the committee, Senate Bill 266 relates to the Governor's Commission on Law Enforcement Medal of Honor, which I'll refer to as the Commission. The commission establishes rules for and nominates candidates for the Law Enforcement Medal of Honor. It presently consists of 5 members who are representatives of the following: 1, the governor's office; 2, the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training; 3, the Oregon Chiefs of Police; 4, the Oregon Sheriff's Association; and then 5, a representative from a statewide police officer organization, is how the statute reads. Senate Bill 266 adds a 6th member, a representative from a statewide organization of peace officers. The motivation behind the bill is to add a representative from, in a sense, both statewide police organizations. We have the 2 main organizations, Oregon Council of Police Associations, and then the Oregon Peace Officer Association. There should be a member from each on the commission. During testimony in the Senate, I recall that Senator Beyer, I believe, asked, why don't we just say the names of the commissions in the bill, in the statute, rather than generically saying a statewide organization of peace officers or a statewide organization of police officers. The response from Legislative Council was, unless the organization or entity is itself created by statute, they don't like to put the names into the statutes in case the names then change later on and the statute would have to be fixed. So that's the reason it wasn't done that way, but that is the intent, to make sure that you're capturing a representative from both of the major police organizations statewide.
Thank you, Council. And we actually have no one signed up to testify on Senate Bill 266, but probably not. I think people are fine with this, so then I will... Representative Flores?
Thank you. I just have a quick question. Is there any problem with putting an even number? Is there ever controversy when these nominations and selections are made so that there needs to be a tiebreaker? Okay.
We see heads wagging no in response to that question, Representative. So unless you would like to hear it on the record, we'll be fine then. Okay, then I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 266 and open a work session on Senate Bill 266.
Mr. Chair, I move 266 to the floor with a due pass.
Representative Barker moves Senate Bill 266 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Hearing none, the clerk call the roll.
Representative
Bonamici.
Aye.
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 Representative
Krieger?
Aye.
Representative
Reed?
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker?
Aye.
Vice Chair
Wisnett?
Aye.
Chair McKinney?
Aye.
Senate Bill 266 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Barker will carry that. Thank you, Representative. Close the work session on Senate Bill 266 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 298A.
Chair McPherson, members of the committee, Senate Bill 298A relates to the permanent driving privilege revocation for certain persons convicted of driving under the influence of intoxicants or DUI. ORS 809.235 provides for the permanent revocation of driving privileges for certain persons convicted of DUI. In relevant part, the statute applies to persons convicted of felony DUI or to persons convicted of misdemeanor DUI for a third or subsequent time. Not all DUIs involve motor vehicles. The DUI statute, 813.010, prohibits, quote, driving a vehicle while under the influence of intoxicants. Occasionally, the state prosecutes persons for operating non-motorized vehicles, for example, bicycles, under the DUI statute. This is often referred to in Multnomah County as a PUI for pedaling under the influence, or as Senator Przanski pointed out, in Lane County it's still a BUI for biking under the influence. In Multnomah County, BUI refers to boating under the influence. So there's some way more than you needed to know. Senate Bill 298 provides that there is no permanent revocation of driving privileges if one of the DUIs, one of your 3, was from a non-motorized vehicle. The burden of proving that a prior DUI conviction was committed while operating a non-motorized vehicle will fall on the defendant. And just so it's clear, first DUI conviction is a 1-year suspension, and then plus you have your interlock device time. Second DUI conviction is 3 years plus your interlock device time. And then the third DUI conviction is when the permanent revocation comes in. This bill would impact persons on that third DUI conviction who wanted to try to not have their permanent licenses revoked permanently to show that one of their prior 3 convictions had been for a non-motorized vehicle.
Thank you, Council. We have Vanita Howard signed up.
Okay.
letters on that.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Vanita Howard. I'm here today representing the Governor's Advisory Committee on Driving Under the Influence of Intoxicants. This bill sort of makes me worry a little bit because at my stage of life, I really would hate to think about trying to ride a bicycle, even sober. But when you think about trying to ride a bicycle drunk, that really worries me. This creates an exception to the permanent revocation of driving privileges, which this body passed in 2003. And as your counsel explained, it involves if one of those offenses is for operating with a bicycle. 814.400 specifically provides that a bicycle is a vehicle for purposes of the vehicle code, and that when the term vehicle is used, the term shall be deemed to be applicable to bicycles. And of course, the DUII law refers not just to motor vehicles, but to vehicles. Those found guilty of attempting to operate a bicycle after repeated convictions for DUI behind the wheel of a motor vehicle, we think must truly have a fairly significant alcohol problem. These riders can be a menace to pedestrians and also create risk for drivers of motor vehicles if those drivers of motor vehicles must take evasive action to avoid a drunk bicyclist careening down the street. I've attached a couple of examples, one from the state of Washington and one from the state of Oregon, of just what kind of drivers we're talking about here. We believe that a bicyclist under the influence is not only dangerous for the rider himself, but for anyone else who might get in the drunk cyclist's path. It would appear from this bill that it affects only a very small number of people. In fact, according to the records at the Motor Vehicles Division, in 2005, there were 4 convictions recorded for drunk on a bicycle. But no matter how small the number might be, the indication is that someone who attempts to ride a bicycle while under the influence, after repeated problems with driving a motor vehicle while under the influence, has a very serious alcohol problem. And I think there's another greater hazard that we need to talk about here, and that is, are we establishing a precedent? If an exception to permanent revocation for the repeat offender is made for a bicycle rider who has a drinking problem, what next? After all, there are electric-assisted bicycles, there are mopeds, there are motor-assisted scooters. We don't get very many of those convictions either, but I hesitate to think about how dangerous it might be for one of them to operate under the influence. And once a precedent is established, it becomes easier to then make another exception. And the law, or the bill rather, is rather broad. It says a non-motorized vehicle. If you look at the code today, there are all kinds of vehicles defined in our law that a few years ago didn't even exist, or at least we didn't know that they existed. Senate Bill 298 may not be earth-shaking in its consequences, but we do caution that it could be the start of a slippery slope on this law. And once we're on a slippery slope, it's hard to stop any vehicle, including a bicycle, whether the rider is drunk or sober. That concludes my statement.
Ms. Howard, I'd like to stay right there, but we get maybe a little out of order here because it would be traditional to hear from the proponents before the opponents. So I think I maybe should hear from Amy Alconich on behalf of the bill, but if you could stay in place, then we could ask questions of you. Ms. Alconich.
She's coming up. Can I ask a question of counsel?
It seems that non-motorized would exclude motorized, like a moped or something. Is that your understanding?
Representative Bonamici, yes. That is my understanding.
So what vehicles, what other vehicles are vehicles under the Motor Vehicles Code but non-motorized besides a bicycle? A unicycle.
Skateboard.
I don't think that's a vehicle under the Motor Vehicle Code.
What about a boat?
The other example of a non-motorized vehicle that can count get you a Dewey is a boat that without a motor on it.
Like a canoe.
A robot.
Right.
Okay. Ms. Alconich.
Chair McPherson, members of the committee, my name is Amy Alconich, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers in support of this bill. I don't think after Matt Kalmanson, Darren Stanford up there, counsel, gave an explanation, and we've already heard testimony on this bill, but not on behalf of it, that there needs to be too much additional explanation. But what I would like to offer is that this doesn't affect the consequences of a PUI, which I can barely say with a straight face, frankly, but it doesn't affect the consequences. You still have to do the alcohol treatment. You still have a license suspension. You still have a criminal conviction. It doesn't affect any of those things that we consider as deterrents for peddling under the influence of intoxicants or I think skateboards may actually apply, although I'm not 100% sure. I think that was an issue in Multnomah County a while ago. So it doesn't affect any of those issues. What it does affect is the permanent revocation statute, which, as we've learned from the previous testimony, is a very small portion of the people convicted of these offenses. This was brought to our attention by a member of our group, and they said that they had a client who had this problem and had encountered over the last few years other clients who had this issue. This bill with the amendments would place the burden on the defendant to show that it was a motorized, non-motorized vehicle as one of their convictions. I don't know if there are any questions from the committee. I don't think this in any way impacts the deterrent factors that I've already talked about, and it would only help those people who have the PUI on their record be able to maintain a driver's license. And we can talk about the reasons why I think that PUIs are not rationally related to their driving privileges if the committee would like to address those.
Representative Flores.
Thank you. I would like to have that discussion because you're connecting this peddling under the influence with some license revocation, and I suspect there are numbers of folks either on bicycles or vulnerable vehicles, which we did hear a week or two ago, that they were skateboards and inline skates and a few others. So if there's no license provision, what's the penalty?
Well, there will be a license provision, like Counsel Stanford discussed, as part of a conviction for a DUI or a BUI or a PUI. There is a license suspension inherent within that statutory structure, and we're not attempting to touch that at all. What we are only addressing is the permanent revocation as a result of one of the convictions being peddling under the influence charge. So we're not addressing the suspension that would come with a court conviction, only the permanent revocation from Department of Motor Vehicles.
If I can just follow up. So we are talking about Dewey convictions, driving while under the influence, and somebody who has a license to do that, and they have to, the burden of proving that one of their three prior convictions didn't involve bicycling or something else that doesn't require a license to do.
Mr. Chair, Representative Flores, that's correct.
Chair,
go ahead.
I'll go back to Representative Flores' comments because I'd written down about these vulnerable persons and where if the vehicle contributed to the accident, that person would have had to attend one of these courses or get this large fine that was there. My objection at the time was that if the person on the skateboard, roller skates, they contributed to it, they weren't required to do anything. So you could have a Dewey on a bicycle cause an accident, and he hasn't have to do anything regarding this thing, even though he caused it. And that was my objection mainly to that bill. And this one here, I'm not certain that I can go along with this yet. We'll see what other testimony we have, but right now I don't think I can be a yes on the bill.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you. Ms. Alconich, is there some timing factor here? Is it possible that it's the three offenses? Is it possible that the third one could be on the bicycle? Or is it driving? Somebody gets the DUI while driving, and then they have to go back and prove that one of the prior was on the bicycle.
Bonamici, I guess it could be either which way. So if any of those three convictions were, how the way the law is right now is that if you have three convictions, this doesn't include a diversion, if you have three convictions for a boating, peddling, or DUI, or any mixture of the three, your license will be suspended. And what we're attempting to change is that if one of those convictions is for a non-motorized vehicle, any one of those three, that you could have a hearing, that you could present information that would say that one of these was non-motorized.
Thank you.
Any further questions for either Ms. Alconich or Ms. Howard? Representative Wisdom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Alconich, so could all three be bicycle DUIs, and you'd lose your driver's license permanently?
It would be PUI.
Yeah.
Chair McPherson, Representative Wisnett, currently if all three of them were peddlings, you would lose your license.
Driver's
and
license.
You would lose your driver's license permanently.
Yeah. Clarification. Thank you.
Absolute comment.
Well, I'm going down the same path as Representative Wisnett. Thank you, Chair McPherson. So if you have three peddling incidents where you were under the influence, you still can get back on your bicycle and still pedal.
There's no license.
There's no license required. So is there an intervention then, along with what we have the classes once, if you're a DUI, you have classes and a consequence of loss of license for a year. Is there any consequence for peddling while you're intoxicated?
Chair McPherson, Representative Comp, and I think this addresses Representative Krieger's issue as well. Absolutely. We're not touching the DUI statute at all. So if you get convicted...
No. I'm not. I'm asking about the bicycle peddler.
Is there
any consequence to their being on the road and possibly causing a hazard, as Representative Krieger has pointed out? Other than they'd possibly be killed, but...
Representative Comp, the consequences are... At that point, you're probably going to jail for quite a while, or potentially headed towards your felony conviction. And I don't know if they do a direct class, frankly, for bicycling under the influence. And there's really no way to prevent somebody from not getting on their bike, over and over and over and over again. But there's still the consequences that are out there for the conviction. And those do include a driver's license suspension, just not the permanent revocation. I don't know if that addresses your question.
Well, my question really is, and I know the answer, but for the record, do you have to have a license in order to pedal a bicycle?
Representative Comp, you do not need a license.
Right.
Chair McPherson, if I may, there's one thing that I think needs to be clear. We've all this discussion of buoys and pooies, and that's how they're referred to. Nobody's convicted of pooey or buoy. It's a DUI. You are convicted of a DUI. It's just the vehicle. Yeah. There's no such conviction. It's DUI.
That was the clarification. Thank you. Sorry.
Any further questions? Then I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 298. I think that will conclude our business for today. Thank you very much, committee. We are adjourned.